This is the listening part of your Year 12 exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1. You have a minute to read the task.
Today, Wendy and I are talking about the chocolate festival that we went to last week in a town called Óbidos, which is about an hour north of Lisbon here in Portugal. But before we get to the chocolate festival, it's worth talking a little bit about Óbidos itself because it's a beautiful little town, right?
It is. It's gorgeous. It's a small medieval town where all of the buildings are whitewashed, but then they also have kind of yellow and blue stripes on the corners of some of them. So it's really beautiful. And then everything is surrounded by a stone wall.
Yeah. So the stone wall is a complete wall that goes all the way around, and more or less all of the buildings inside are very uniform. You can walk along the entire stretch of the walls. There are some towers that you can get up as well, and then you get a great view of the surrounding area. So it's really lovely.
Yeah, and we were lucky with the weather this time. It was still quite windy, which I think is normal for that area because I saw lots of windmills, both on the bus as we were heading there, and then also from Óbidos itself, when you're up on the walls and looking out over the countryside, you can see quite a few modern windmills, and you can also see others that are centuries old, but you can tell that it was always a windy place.
So it's quite a touristy town. I don't think we can pretend it's an undiscovered site. It's close enough to Lisbon that it's a day trip from Lisbon, and so a lot of people do go there. What we did this time was we went a little bit earlier than we needed to go because the chocolate festival started at 11 a.m. and we decided to go and get there at about 10 a.m. and that was great because there was really nobody there at that time. But then, yeah, by about 11 o'clock, some busloads of people started to arrive. So as we said, we went for the chocolate festival, and they have this every year, and it goes for quite some time, for like a month, right?
Yeah, I think it's at least a month, but yeah, it's not every day of the week. I think it's just Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for, say, 4 weeks in a row.
And one of the good things about it is that the chocolate festival is held inside the castle, and we hadn't been inside before, so that was a little bonus as well. And so what's the chocolate festival all about?
It's all about chocolate. So there are lots of stalls that are set up by different little companies that sell chocolate. Sometimes they'll sell more inventive things. I think I saw something there that they called a choco burger. So it was in the shape of a hamburger, but what would have been the patty was made of chocolate. And then they put whipped cream on top of that and then put it between two pieces of bread, like a hamburger bun. So yeah, there were lots of kind of innovative ways of using chocolate. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And then there are also some workshops where you can make your own chocolate pizza, for example. And then they have like cooking demonstrations as well, where chefs will come and show an audience how to make these different dishes, and they're all using chocolate.
There are also some people doing entertainment kind of things related to chocolate. And if you're not into chocolate, well, you can go to Óbidos any other time of the year, and it's a great little town to spend a day in, taking in all the little sights.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Today, Wendy and I are talking about the chocolate festival that we went to last week in a town called Ogduz, which is about an hour north of Lisbon here in Portugal. But before we get to the chocolate festival, it's worth talking a little bit about Ogduz itself because it's a beautiful little town, right?
It is. It's gorgeous. It's a small medieval town where all of the buildings are whitewashed, but then they also have kind of yellow and blue stripes on the corners of some of them. So it's really beautiful. And then everything is surrounded by a stone wall.
Yeah, so the stone wall is a complete wall that goes all the way around, and more or less all of the buildings inside are very uniform. You can walk along the entire stretch of the walls. There are some towers that you can get up as well, and then you get a great view of the surrounding area. So it's really lovely.
Yeah, and we were lucky with the weather this time. It was still quite windy, which I think is normal for that area, because I saw lots of windmills, both on the bus as we were heading there, and then also from Obidus itself, when you're up on the walls and looking out over the countryside, you can see quite a few modern windmills, and you can also see others that are centuries old, but you can tell that it was always a windy place.
So it's quite a touristy town. I don't think we can pretend it's an undiscovered site. It's close enough to Lisbon that it's a day trip from Lisbon, and so a lot of people do go there. What we did this time was we went a little bit earlier than we needed to go because the chocolate festival started at 11 a.m. and we decided to go and get there at about 10 a.m. and that was great because there was really nobody there at that time. But then, yeah, by about 11 o'clock, some busloads of people started to arrive. So as we said, we went for the chocolate festival, and they have this every year, and it goes for quite some time, for like a month, right?
Yeah, I think it's at least a month, but yeah, it's not every day of the week. I think it's just Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for, say, 4 weeks in a row.
And one of the good things about it is that the chocolate festival is held inside the castle, and we hadn't been inside before, so that was a little bonus as well. And so what's the chocolate festival all about?
It's all about chocolate. So there are lots of stalls that are set up by different little companies that sell chocolate. Sometimes they'll sell more inventive things. I think I saw something there that they called a choco burger. So it was in the shape of a hamburger, but the what would have been the patty was made of chocolate. And then they put whipped cream on top of that and then put it between two pieces of bread, like a hamburger bun. So yeah, there were lots of kind of innovative ways of using chocolate. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And then there are also some workshops where you can make your own chocolate pizza, for example. And then they have like cooking demonstrations as well, where chefs will come and show an audience how to make these different dishes, and they're all using chocolate.
There are also some people doing entertainment kind of things related to chocolate. And if you're not into chocolate, well, you can go to Obidush any other time of the year, and it's a great little town to spend a day in, taking in all the little sights.
There is a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have a minute to read the task.
At first glance, the Arctic and Antarctic have very similar environments. I needed someone with first-hand experience of Antarctica to help me answer this question. Dr. Ian Staniland from the British Antarctic Survey told me why we might want to move polar bears in the first place.
Starving polar bears desperately clinging to lumps of melting ice is an image that most people relate to regarding global warming and the threats to wildlife. And given their iconic status, it has even been suggested that we could save the polar bear by translocating them to the Antarctic.
But would they be more successful hunting at the South Pole? Let's drop them in and find out.
Polar bears would do very well if transplanted into the Antarctic, well, at least for a few years. From a food point of view, it'd be polar bear heaven. In the Arctic, the seals and other potential prey species have evolved lifestyles that minimise their risk of being eaten by polar bears. But in contrast, larger Antarctic animals such as seals and penguins have evolved without this risk of being eaten. Because of this, the penguins are typically quite bold and inquisitive and will often approach you to have a look. And seals in the Antarctic range in behaviour from total indifference to outright aggression. For example, Antarctic fur seals have a reputation for chasing and trying to bite people. And whilst this is great for tourism and researchers, well, except for getting bitten, obviously, it would make Antarctic wildlife the equivalent of an all-you-can-eat buffet as far as polar bears are concerned. The most obvious effect of putting polar bears into the Antarctic would be a catastrophic decline in the seal and penguin populations and some very fat and happy bears.
So far, so good for the polar bears. Although news isn't so good for the penguins. Are there any other benefits for polar bears in Antarctica?
Given that most of the industrialised nations are in the Northern Hemisphere and are encircling the Arctic, it's no surprise that polar bears are basically being poisoned by their food. The remoteness of Antarctica and its greater separation from these sources of pollution means that whilst such toxins are found in the environment, the levels are currently much less significant.
Plenty of food and less pollution. This all sounds too good to be true.
But it's not all good news for the polar bears. There are also several less obvious factors that come into play. There would be many unknowns, such as the risk of the bears of exposure to new diseases, and then what would happen when the bears have eaten all the seals and penguins. History teaches us that animal translocations often have unpredictable results, and so it's probably best that polar bears and penguins only meet on badly designed Christmas cards.
Thanks, Ian. I'm sure all penguin lovers will agree the solution to polar bear conservation lies in protecting their Arctic habitat, not moving them south.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
At first glance, the Arctic and Antarctic have very similar environments. I needed someone with first-hand experience of Antarctica to help me answer this question. Dr. Ian Staniland from the British Antarctic Survey told me why we might want to move polar bears in the first place.
Starving polar bears desperately clinging to lumps of melting ice is an image that most people relate to regarding global warming and the threats to wildlife. And given their iconic status, it has even been suggested that we could save the polar bear by translocating them to the Antarctic.
But would they be more successful hunting at the South Pole? Let's drop them in and find out.
Polar bears would do very well if transplanted into the Antarctic, well, at least for a few years. From a food point of view, it'd be polar bear heaven. In the Arctic, the seals and other potential prey species have evolved lifestyles that minimise their risk of being eaten by polar bears. But in contrast, larger Antarctic animals such as seals and penguins have evolved without this risk of being eaten. Because of this, the penguins are typically quite bold and inquisitive and will often approach you to have a look. And seals in the Antarctic range in behaviour from total indifference to outright aggression. For example, Antarctic fur seals have a reputation for chasing and trying to bite people. And whilst this is great for tourism and researchers, well, except for getting bitten, obviously, it would make Antarctic wildlife the equivalent of an all-you-can-eat buffet as far as polar bears are concerned. The most obvious effect of putting polar bears into the Antarctic would be a catastrophic decline in the seal and penguin populations and some very fat and happy bears.
So far, so good for the polar bears. Although news isn't so good for the penguins. Are there any other benefits for polar bears in Antarctica?
Given that most of the industrialised nations are in the Northern Hemisphere and are encircling the Arctic, it's no surprise that polar bears are basically being poisoned by their food. The remoteness of Antarctica and its greater separation from these sources of pollution means that whilst such toxins are found in the environment, the levels are currently much less significant.
Plenty of food and less pollution. This all sounds too good to be true.
But it's not all good news for the polar bears. There are also several less obvious factors that come into play. There would be many unknowns, such as the risk of the bears of exposure to new diseases, and then what would happen when the bears have eaten all the seals and penguins. History teaches us that animal translocations often have unpredictable results, and so it's probably best that polar bears and penguins only meet on badly designed Christmas cards.
Thanks, Ian. I'm sure all penguin lovers will agree the solution to polar bear conservation lies in protecting their Arctic habitat, not moving them south.
There is a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. Go on to task 3. You have a minute to read the task.
Well, here in the studio to fill us in on the evolution of dance is Ian Cross. He's Professor of Music at Cambridge University. Hi, Ian. So why did dance evolve in the first place? Why do we do it?
Probably for the same reason that language evolved, to enable us to engage with each other, and primarily to engage with each other socially.
Do we know when it came?
No, we really don't. Well, it's unlikely to have happened before we became particularly bipedal, so it's going to be post-Australopithecine.
But I do like the idea of apes in trees sort of jigging around.
Well, interesting you should say that. Until a couple of years ago, I didn't really believe any of the evidence that suggested that chimpanzees could keep in time with each other, until I saw some material from the Kyoto Primate Lab in Japan, which showed pretty unambiguously that chimps can tap along in time with each other. In other words, chimps could do something like dance with each other, but only if they're good mates or they're related.
Right, they don't want to dance with strangers, yeah. Then, just like most of us.
And that's probably the difference between them and us, that we can dance with strangers. There's some very interesting ethnographic evidence. For instance, when the first fleet landed in Botany Bay in Australia in 1788, more or less the first thing that happened was that some of the sailors danced with some of the indigenous peoples.
Right, okay. And you mentioned we think that dance evolved because of a social thing. Is there anything else it might be good for? And has anyone done any studies into this?
We did a study about 3 or 4 years ago where we looked at people dancing together and the effect that that had on memory. We used silent disco technology to enable us to have two groups of people dancing in the same space but to different pieces of music. Silent disco technology, if for those who don't know, is wireless headphones with a base station. The base station can broadcast the music, and you've usually got 2 or 3 or maybe half a dozen different channels in the base station. We used 2 different channels, 2 different pieces of music, so half the people were dancing to one piece and half were dancing to a different piece at a different tempo, a different speed.
Right, and what effect did that have on people's memory, did you say?
Well, what we did was control the ways in which they could interact with each other, so everyone spent as much time in proximity to people dancing at the same tempo as dancing at the different tempo. People were wearing different coloured sashes, and half of them were wearing badges. What we found was that people remembered the colour of the sashes that people dancing to the same tempo were wearing, and remembered whether or not people dancing at the same tempo were wearing badges, but didn't remember nearly so well when they were dancing to a different tempo.
Right, so dancing might actually help us remember things about the people we're dancing with. Why would that be a good thing, evolutionary speaking?
Well, what you're remembering are incidental features, features that are not focally attended to. It's pretty good just to check out, can I cope with this person? Can I engage with this person? Will I be able to communicate with this person? Some other research has shown that we're more likely to like people we have been in time with than people we've been out of time with.
Thank you, Ian. So I guess instead of blaming it on the boogie, you should blame it on evolution for our love of dancing.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Well, here in the studio to fill us in on the evolution of dance is Ian Cross. He's Professor of Music at Cambridge University. Hi, Ian. So why did dance evolve in the first place? Why do we do it?
Probably for the same reason that language evolved, to enable us to engage with each other, and primarily to engage with each other socially.
Do we know when it came?
No, we really don't. Well, it's unlikely to have happened before we became particularly bipedal, so it's going to be post-Australopithecine.
But I do like the idea of apes in trees sort of jigging around.
Well, interesting you should say that. Until a couple of years ago, I didn't really believe any of the evidence that suggested that chimpanzees could keep in time with each other, until I saw some material from the Kyoto Primate Lab in Japan, which showed pretty unambiguously that chimps can tap along in time with each other. In other words, chimps could do something like dance with each other, but only if they're good mates or they're related.
Right, they don't want to dance with strangers then, just like most of us.
And that's probably the difference between them and us, that we can dance with strangers. There's some very interesting ethnographic evidence. For instance, when the first fleet landed in Botany Bay in Australia in 1788, more or less the first thing that happened was that some of the sailors danced with some of the indigenous peoples.
Right, okay. And you mentioned we think that dance evolved because of a social thing. Is there anything else it might be good for? And has anyone done any studies into this?
We did a study about 3 or 4 years ago where we looked at people dancing together and the effect that that had on memory. We used silent disco technology to enable us to have two groups of people dancing in the same space but to different pieces of music. Silent disco technology, if for those who don't know, is wireless headphones with a base station. The base station can broadcast the music, and you've usually got 2 or 3 or maybe 6 different channels on the base station. We used 2 different channels, 2 different pieces of music, so half the people were dancing to one piece and half were dancing to a different piece at a different tempo, a different speed.
Right, and what effect did that have on people's memory, did you say?
Well, what we did was control the ways in which they could interact with each other, so everyone spent as much time in proximity to people dancing at the same tempo as dancing at the different tempo. People were wearing different coloured sashes and half of them were wearing badges. What we found was that people remembered the colour of the sashes that people dancing to the same tempo were wearing and remembered whether or not people dancing to the same tempo were wearing badges, but didn't remember nearly so well when they were dancing to a different tempo.
Right, so dancing might actually help us remember things about the people we're dancing with. Why would that be a good thing, evolutionary speaking?
Well, what you're remembering are incidental features, features that are not focally attended to. It's pretty good just to check out, can I cope with this person? Can I engage with this person? Will I be able to communicate with this person? Some other research has shown that we're more likely to like people we have been in time with than people we've been out of time with.
Thank you, Ian. So I guess instead of blaming it on the boogie, you should blame it on evolution for our love of dancing.
There is a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of Task 3 and the whole listening test.